Shalom. Welcome to another episode of Inspiration from Zion. I'm Jonathan Feldstein, and I have the privilege of being your host, coming to you from the Judean Mountains here in Israel. I like to refer to it as the original Bible Belt. Inspiration from Zion is a program of the Genesis 123 Foundation, whose mission is to build bridges between Jews and Christians with Israel in ways that are new, unique, and meaningful. I pray that you will find this all of those. Through this program, we're excited to connect you to people and stories in and relating to Israel, giving you a window to look through, experiencing aspects of life here that you might not otherwise know about. We want this to be interactive, so please be in touch with us at inspirationfromzion@gmail.com and send along any questions and any comments about any topic anytime. Or you can reach us at genesis123.co. and follow and like Inspiration from Zion on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Stay tuned until the end, where, as always, we're going to give you an exciting opportunity, and feel free to share this with others who will also find it of interest. Today, we are recording live at a time on 10 o'clock in the morning on Thursday, the 15th of May, coinciding with what our enemies refer to as Nakba Day. And we are doing so, particularly bringing in an audience from Australia, New Zealand, Africa, and other parts of Asia and Europe. And we're excited to have everyone joining us, and anyone who's following afterward in Europe, waking up, or in the Americas, or any other part of the world. We welcome you, and we'll be interested to see how on target the conversation is, if not prophetic, and what future developments are. The title of the conversation today, loosely, very, is Trump, Iran, the Saudis, Qatar, Israel, Hamas, the Houthis, Gaza and the hostages, and everything you were afraid to ask. And with us to have this conversation, I've got two friends, Major Elliot Chodoff, who is a frequent guest, probably our most frequent guest in the last, I think, 4 years of Inspiration from Zion. It's always a pleasure to have Elliot with us. He's a political and military analyst specializing in the Middle East and the global war on terror and the intersection of these. He is a decorated officer, a respected speaker, and frequently published commentator in a wide range of major news sites and journals. He served in the IDF for 35 years, and he served in active duty during the 2006 Lebanon War and in Gush Katif during the 2005 Gaza disengagement. He's currently completing his PhD in international relations at Bar-Ilan University, and has his own podcast. Elliot, forgive me, I don't remember the title.
Conflict Uncovered.
Conflict Uncovered. We're going to add that to your bio so I don't forget that next time.
Okay.
It's always a pleasure, Elliot, really. Barry Shaw.
Always a pleasure to be with you.
Barry is somebody I always follow as well, was with great insight, also coming from Israel. Barry is the public diplomacy associate at the Institute for Strategic Studies and host of an interview and news program called The View from Israel. He has authored several books, including Fighting Hamas, BDS, and Anti-Semitism, as a warning to the West for abandoning its Judeo-Christian values. I didn't list all of the books, Barry, but others include BDS for Idiots, Israel Reclaiming the Narrative, 1917 From Palestine to the Land of Israel, Correcting False Narratives that Ignore Actual Events and Facts Regarding Arab Possession, Ownership, or Nationhood West of the Jordan River. Barry, I always follow you. I love it when I have in my social media feed all of your tremendous insight. It was nice to see you, albeit unfortunate for the circumstances, about 4 months ago at Olga Washington's funeral, where we were, the three of us, along with hundreds of others, were together. And I want to welcome you as a first-time participant on Inspiration from Zion.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So, gentlemen, we're going to jump straight in. There's been a lot of activity, a lot of chatter, leading up to and during. We find ourselves in the tail end of President Trump's current trip to the Middle East. A lot of activity before that had a lot of people concerned, raising eyebrows. An issue just a week ago, no, week and a half ago now, with the president announcing a ceasefire deal between the United States and the Houthis the day after the Houthis successfully launched a rocket and hit Ben-Gurion Airport, negotiations that have been taking place on a weekly basis with Iran toward ostensibly preventing Iran from ever having a nuclear weapon. But unfortunately, those of us who know negotiations with Iran and nuclear weapons know that those have not succeeded historically. And so we're looking at it with a little bit of cynicism. And the release, thank God, this week of Eden Alexander, the final living American Israeli hostage, leaving 58. There are other things, but it's a bit head spinning, to be honest. And then President Trump got on a plane and landed in Saudi Arabia to, pun intended, a royal welcome, and had a very high visibility day or day and a half in Saudi Arabia before flying off to Qatar, which is where I believe he is as we speak. Before we get into, we have to be intellectually honest about what's going on, and that's why I wanted to have this conversation with you. But before we unpack some of the things that are making us, perhaps, and other conservatives in Israel, in the United States, even people who support President Trump, uncomfortable, I love to ask the both of you, and either of you can start, what are the good things that you've seen come out of President Trump's visit and the lead up to it? And maybe we'll only discuss the good things if that's where the conversation goes.
Do you want me to start, Elliot? No, you.
You just did.
Go for it.
Okay. Good things coming out of Trump's trip to the Middle East was fine. He's got a $5.5 billion golf hotel resort contract with Qatar. He's got a $400 million plane to substitute the one that Boeing is building right now. He's got other contracts with Saudi Arabia, and I'm sure others as well. that is the good news that I see out of it. And if you want me to go back with regards to the way you opened up about the Houthis and the U.S. involvement there, I'd like to give your viewers some added information they may not have received by the U.S. media.
I do, but I want to focus, if it's under the banner of good things, I want to focus on it because I'd like to start this off in a positive way. If it's gonna go in a different direction, which is fine, then I want to wait about 3 or 4 minutes until Elliot chimes in about other good things that have taken place.
In that case, I'll wait because
that's what I suspected.
In fact, but does end up some positive news vis-a-vis Israel.
So, Elliot, Barry sees an Arabian ATM. What else is good that's come out of?
Well, first of all, let me start by agreeing with Barry. I think that Trump and the United States are coming out ahead on the balance sheet, if you count it in millions and billions of dollars. But I'm going to be slightly more optimistic and add the release of Eden Alexander, with all of the problematics around it, getting him out, and certainly at no direct cost to Israel. And I'm going to emphasize direct because we don't know what promises were made and what's going on there behind the scenes. But getting him out was certainly a positive aspect. And I think that with all of, once again, many of the issues that I have with background and method, we should keep in mind that with the Saudis, with Jilani, and that meeting was extremely problematic, Trump is constantly hammering the Abraham Accords.
Jilani, for those who are following who don't know, Elliot, is the new quota
leader,
president,
leader of Syria. Okay, ostensibly former Al Qaeda and Jabhat al Nusra will leave the word ostensibly in there because the jury is still out on that. But looking at it from what Trump is doing, Israel is in the subject there, whether by direct naming or by implication. And here, once again, positive in the sense that I think Trump has abandoned Israel crowd, I think, are overstating the case. It's Israel is still in the mix there and in the positive end of the mix. And I'll finish, I'm sorry, with something of a caveat, not so much a downside. I always say, dear Lord, protect me from my friends. I know how to deal with my enemies. Sometimes that kind of friendship can be very condescending, and an idea of, and we've seen this from America over many administrations, we know better than Israel what Israel needs, and we're going to impose that, what we know, on Israel, which is very often not to Israel's benefit. Okay. So it's a mixed bag, but there are positive aspects in there. And actually, one final point on this, Trump being Trump, you really never know what's going to come out of it. Is he going to push it seriously? Let's remember his, if the hostages aren't released by Saturday, all hell is going to break loose. And the hostages weren't released and hell hasn't broken loose.
He didn't say which Saturday.
Well, he did then.
Oh, okay.
He fires stuff out, and sometimes he follows through. Sometimes he forgets it. Sometimes he even denies he said it. I will say this, and I think I can speak for Barry as well. It's really disconcerting to try to be an analyst with Trump as president, because you have absolutely no idea which direction he's going, and I'm not even sure he knows which direction he's going when he gets up in the morning. So we have to be a little
okay,
cautious about both the positives and the negatives of what he's doing, although there are certain things I think that we could be unequivocal about, and we'll get into that in the continuation of the conversation.
Right. So I want to do that, but I want to take off in a direction that you just went, Elliot, in speaking about those who are mistaken that Trump has abandoned Israel. That's a very easy reflexive thing for people who are prone to be anti-Trump and anything that he does to say, aha, look, I told you so. But that's right. Not necessarily the case. The jury is out, and I kind of concur with what you're saying. And it's hard to be an analyst. So I do want to talk about specifics, but I love both also to frame the conversation where I think we're going to get to explore some of the things that are making us as Israelis and other conservatives uncomfortable. Why is it that Trump supporting conservatives are having trouble with all or some of his trip right now? Barry, you wanted to say something probably on a different topic, but I wanted to try to focus the wider picture and then go into the specifics.
Yeah, okay. But what I have to say has to do what you said as well about Israel being on the bus with Trump and other partners in the Middle East. But putting it my way, and I think Elliot might agree with me, right now he's put Israel in the back seat of the bus. With regard to the release of Aidan Alexander, of course it was very welcome. There's nothing, the prior demand here in Israel is the release of our hostages. But let's be honest, the timing of Aidan Alexander's release was orchestrated to be a wedge between Israel and America. And it was orchestrated between one of the negotiators, Qatar, and in fact with Hamas. Because if you think that Qatar, as a mediator, is not closely embedded with Hamas, we can talk about that in great detail and find out that Qatar is the main funder and other things, a propaganda chief of Hamas. But coming back to Aidan Alexander, as I said, he was released as a wedge between Israel and America in advance of Trump's trip to the Middle East, and as a pause for the war in Gaza, which only benefits Hamas.
The restoration of Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel was an earth-shattering event. For Christians, it was a confirmation that God always keeps his covenantal promises. Today, we are blessed to see God's fingerprints in the modern miracle of the land of Israel playing out in our lives among the people and in the state of Israel. This year, On the occasion of Israel's 75th anniversary, the Genesis 123 Foundation has been privileged to bring together 75 Christian leaders from around the world to lend their unique voices, sharing their personal faith experiences relating to Israel and their in-depth insight into Israel's history and spiritual significance to create an historical, one-of-a-kind, high-end coffee table book, Israel the Miracle. Israel the Miracle's stunning imagery will fill your home with the hope of fulfilled promises and conversations about Israel. It's a perfect gift to anybody for any occasion, and most of all, to yourself. You'll also be a blessing to Israel, knowing that the proceeds will go to bless Israelis of all backgrounds. Be a part of Israel the Miracle and bring the land, the people, and the state of Israel into your heart and into your home. Visit IsraelTheMiracle.com to get your limited edition copy today.
Okay. No disagreement. I'd love for you to comment on the sort of the broader issue. You've picked on an important one. Why is it that conservatives now are having trouble? Trump supporting conservatives. We've seen it in Congress. We've seen it in the Senate. We've seen it in the media. Why are people having trouble with the trip and some of the optics? You want to touch on that, Barry?
Let me start off with this, if I may, Elliot. That I think the conservatives in America, and I would put them as the Judeo-Christian wing of the Republican Party, are somewhat disturbed because what we're hearing from certain left-wing sources, Democrat sources in the United States, was that, yeah, you went after Biden because of his personal corruption between him and his son. And what we're watching in the Middle East is Trump and his family feathering their beds with multi-billion dollar deals. In fact, it didn't escape the critics, the American critics, even in America, to explain or say that in fact, when Trump landed in Qatar after being in Saudi Arabia, one of the people there to greet him was his son, Eric Trump, who is in fact in charge of the Trump empire in Qatar. And he is dealing with the Qataris and the Saudis about the new massive $5 billion deal that is being held in Qatar, as well as the business he's been boasting about in Saudi Arabia. And the American critics, including, as you said, some of the conservatives, are muttering a little bit about, well, how is this different to the Biden corruption?
Okay, good point. Elliot, as one who I know likes to quote from The Godfather, I didn't know that Eric Trump was there to greet his father when he landed. I'm seeing the little Sonny Corleone greeting Michael in Las Vegas. That didn't go very well, did it?
No. And first of all, let me add that it's a little more family oriented than even Barry spoke about, because in addition to the Trump sons, they are in partnership with Witkoff sons.
Ouch.
In other words, yeah, it's a little bit wider than just Trump. And when you look at the package, you know, Witkoff is running around Qatar and these places, and his family is in for billions as well.
As we know, Witkoff is indebted to the Qataris for getting off the real estate
to the tune to the tune of $623 million.
Right. Yeah.
And so that the airplane. Yes, you know that I like to quote The Godfather. This has a lot of the element of the Qataris playing The Godfather and saying, I believe in friendship and I believe in showing my friendship first. And someday, and that day may never come, I'm going to ask you for a favor.
Okay.
That's implicit in all of this.
So why has three Israeli men, Barry, I assume you have dual citizenship as well, but Elliot and I as American dual American citizens. Why is this, which has now come up in a broader question about why conservatives are uncomfortable, and we went straight to a financial issue, right? Why is that a concern for us as conservative Israelis?
Can I start off by answering this by saying that Qatar is a country that needs to be deeply, deeply troubling to people who care, the what I would call the conservatives, America, the Judeo-Christians or whatever in America. Because apart from Qatar being the main sponsor of Hamas and as well as Al-Qaeda and having Al Jazeera and all these anti-Western, not only anti-Israel organizations, Trump is making the right steps even in the United States when it comes to the anti-Semitism on U.S. campuses by imposing punishment, financial punishment, on the universities that have been allowing this anti-Jewish, anti-Israel, pro-Hamas protest and activism to take place. But what he has not spoken about in America is, in fact, questioning and looking into the foreign influence and the foreign money that has led to this indoctrination. And who is the head of the pack on that? It's Qatar, that has an aggressive multi-billion dollar campaign to control U.S. institutions, posing a direct threat to American national security, as well as the fact their strategic payments into the campuses to for decades. Elliot can elaborate on this. In order to bring in the lecturers and the teachers and the professors that have taken the next generation of American influence makers and decision makers to a far more dangerous place, i.e. following the route that Qatar wants them to follow, which is anti-Israel, anti-Semitic, anti-American philosophies, values, standards, etc. And we can see this playing out on the campuses today.
Okay. Elliot, anything you want to add to that specifically about why we're concerned about Qatar and its influence?
Sure. Well, first of all, let's in addition to the campuses and the influence in Israel as well as America, Qatari money has found its way very, very high up in government circles. The cases here are still under investigation, but the facts, at least on the level of Qatari money getting into people, even in the prime minister's office, in the United States, we're talking about money going to not currently, but the attorney general, the head of the FBI, of the FBI. Again, I believe in friendship, but someday I'm going to ask a favor. That's all on one level. There's an additional aspect that we need to keep in mind. And Barry talked about the actions of Qatar, Al Jazeera, and supporting Hamas and all that, and absolutely, and being behind a lot of the anti-Israel / anti-Semitism in American campuses. There's a background step here, sort of zoom back a bit. Qatar is a Wahhabist center. The Wahhabis are the core of radical Islam today. The Muslim Brotherhood didn't start as Wahhabi, but it picked up on Wahhabism. And through that, we see what spun out to Khomeinism, Al-Qaeda, ISIS. That all comes out of the same core ideology. It's not a coincidence that Al-Qaeda's leadership either came from or came through Saudi Arabia. Today, the Saudis are, let's say, maybe a bit less. However, and I think, and this is really key, in the 20th century, the Wahhabis learned to, there's a saying in Yiddish, you can't dance at two weddings. The Wahhabis learned to dance at two weddings. In other words, they learned to deal pragmatically with camouflage with the West, starting with the Brits and then later with the Americans. And the Qataris are doing the same thing, while at the same time supporting radical Islamic jihadi movements throughout the world. And they do it seamlessly. So they can have an American base in Qatar and be funding Al-Qaeda and anti-American movements all around the world. This is extremely dangerous, especially when you think of the Abraham Accords and bringing everyone in. Which side are we seeing and what are we not seeing on the other side? It's extremely dangerous on that level as well.
Let me, David, can I jump in with one more addition to what Elliot just explained?
Please.
With regard to Qatar, right? I want your viewers to understand that, right, quite frankly, Qatar's financial maneuvers are akin to a Trojan horse. They're entering now. Trump is opening the gates of Troy, and that Trojan horse is within the gates, basically. Let me add one fact, that Qatar may, and Trump may mention this, that Qatar is allowing the use on their soil of a U.S. base. I want your viewers to know that that base came with one condition, that the United States cannot use that base to defend Israel. In other words, if Israel is under attack, America, U.S. can do what they want to try and defend Israel from the attack, but they cannot do it from the base in Qatar. Ditto, by the way, Turkey. U.S. also has a base in Turkey that comes with that condition as well.
Well, we're going to come to Turkey in a little bit. Thank you for that. I didn't know those issues. And as part of the deal with Qatar, what is it, $160 billion purchase from Boeing? I think they're going to be getting a lot more airplanes in the next decade over there. I don't know if they're all military or commercial, but certainly a lot of money. And that money comes with favors down the road. The other thing, by the way, I want to move from Qatar. The other thing that's concerning me is that investments are great, but investments also mean part ownership, if not full ownership. And whether it's China owning mass industry or real estate or other things in the U.S. or Russia or Qatar or any other bad actor, it may create American jobs. It may pump up the industry in the United States, but it also comes with a long range price, and that's something that needs to be considered. Barry,
I want to strengthen what you just said there, because if you take Qatar as an example, it is against the law in the United States for U.S. president to do business or take money from a foreign entity or profit from a foreign entity. Now, we talked about the $5 billion contract that the Trump organization is doing in Qatar. Now, Trump's may argue that, in fact, they're not doing it with the government of Qatar. They're doing it with some development company that's jointly in Qatar and Saudi Arabia. But guess what? The owners of the Qatar development company is the Qatar government.
Sure. You're reminding me of what my Soviet studies professor used to refer to the Communist Party and the government as a hand-in-glove relationship. And this is a similar instance. So thank you for that. Let me pivot across the water there for a moment, vis-a-vis Iran. Negotiations have been going on. I don't know, honestly, to the extent that the Qataris have a good or bad or indifferent relationship with Iran, but we know that the Emiratis don't. We know that the Saudis don't have a good relationship with Iran. We know that any talk about nuclear power, eventually nuclear weapons in the Arabian Peninsula, would be as a direct challenge to a nuclear threat from Iran. I haven't read anything specifically this week or heard anything in terms of what's the subtext or specific conversations with Trump vis-a-vis his negotiations with Iran and protecting quote-unquote Arab allies. Have you heard anything? And what's your sense of how the negotiations that the U.S. initiated a little over a month ago are impacting this trip or impacting the negotiations?
I have a rule of thumb that when negotiations are going on of any type, which is a priori not to believe anything made public.
Okay.
Okay. I listen to what's being said. I read what's being written. I ask myself, why is this information being put out there?
Good.
But I don't necessarily believe it as truth. And With Trump, I'll ratchet that up a number of levels. First of all, anytime there are negotiations going on, he's going to say, well, we're moving forward. It's great. This is the greatest negotiation that's ever happened in the history of humanity. That's his style. And he, in order to push forward, and this is part of the nature of negotiations, you're always going to say, they were very productive and the other side is being very, very accommodating and that sort of thing, which, by the way, the Iranians are. These guys have been selling carpets for 1,000 years. They know how to do it. The bottom line is, and I will put this with the Iran negotiations, with the hostage negotiations, with Hamas, until it's closed, there's no such thing as close, because one negotiating technique, and our Middle Eastern neighbors know this very well, much better than the Americans do, and the Americans learned this the hard way at Camp David with Arafat, is agree to everything up until the last point, and then make all of your serious, heavy demands when everything is this close to an agreement, or at least seemingly so. And that way your adversary who wants to make a deal will say, all we have to do is give them this and we can close it. And of course you give them that and they say, well, but there's also this. And then there's also this. And forever? No. How about 15 years? And so on. And that's the way the negotiations work. One of the issues here and one of the things that concerned me is an American propensity, and it's not just Trump. I think, once again, Trump is on his own level of this, but an American propensity to want to close the deal more than gaining what they wanted from going into the negotiations in the first place. And this goes back even to the Vietnam era, when Kissinger negotiated the end of that war. One of the commentaries afterwards was there were two different objectives here. America went in to end the war and the North Vietnamese went in to win the war.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we can see a very similar kind of asymmetry here in American negotiations in the Middle East, and in particular with Iran.
Friends, Israel's at war, and the war may get worse before it gets better. Much worse. It's going to be a long war because the enemy is the epitome of evil. It's not just a matter of overcoming troops on a battlefield, but overcoming a theology, an ideology, an evil one. While the Genesis 123 Foundation has been overwhelmed with the support of so many donations to the Israel Emergency Campaign, there's so much more that needs to be done. We've invested your donations that we've received so far strategically to make the biggest impact possible, whether helping with soldiers and their equipment and personal needs, to providing civilian security for outlying border communities, to relocating and settling several families from near the Gaza war zone, launching the global petition drive to support Israel in the face of pressure for a ceasefire, and long-term needs for at-risk children, traumatized now more than ever before. Please take a moment to pause this conversation right now and go to love.genesis123.co and donate generously. We value your trust, and we will keep all donors informed about how and where your donations are being used to contribute to make the biggest impact possible. And when you use that link, love.genesis123.co, you can also send your prayers and words of encouragement to Israelis of all backgrounds. Just sending your love, something that we need so desperately. Thank you, and God bless you and your loved ones.
One of my big criticisms of Kamala Harris during the campaign was that she would continually parrot the phrase that we need to get a deal done, get a deal done, get a deal done. She had substance to what that meant, but in her mind, getting a deal done was the golden rule,
that's very American,
right? And that's a good point. Barry, do you want to add anything to that about Iran and what we're seeing or might be seeing, albeit cautioned by Elliot's initial advice not to believe anything we see until it's done?
Yeah, I agree with both of you. You can't do a deal just for the sake of doing a deal. And one of the things I think that's pieces of the jigsaw that's missing is if Trump had a prolonged private conversation with Espia, whether Iran came up, I have a feeling it must have done. And what he heard from the Crown Prince, did the Crown Prince say to him that in fact Iran is an enemy of us and other moderate Arab states in the region, and therefore don't fall for their foolery the way he's falling for Qatari foolery, or maybe even Saudi group, let's put it that way. But quite frankly, as you said, Iranians are the best barterers in the world. They have the shook mentality, and they will outsmart you every time you go to buy whatever you want to buy. And it's that danger that they're going to do the same on Trump. The question is, if the Crown Prince did anything to cement in Trump's mind the need and the necessity to ignore the false promises that the Iranian regime are going to give him to spin the wheels and wait until he's finished his remaining term as president before going full steam ahead, because they have a clock and they have the patience as well. Or whether the NBS would have told him, you can't believe a word they say, you must hold them to a deadline, and if they do not meet that deadline, then do what you said you were going to do to grasp that, and that is all hell will let loose. I don't know. Like you said, I agree with Elliot. A lot of the truth lies in the privacy of negotiations and not in the public statements.
Right, and to my reading of it, and that's not exhaustive, there's been no statements about Iran. That doesn't mean that there haven't been. I just didn't catch it. But the one thing we do need to note is that Trump left Iran having signed $142 billion military package with the Saudis.
Saudi Arabia.
Right. And the Saudis aren't defending themselves against Israel. They aren't defending themselves against Jordan. They do have a little issue with the Houthis in Yemen, and perhaps that'll be taken care of. They don't particularly like the Qataris. But the military threat that the Saudis need this $142 billion package is across what they're currently calling the Persian Gulf.
Can I raise the point here, because you raised it about the Houthis? And I want to talk about the irony of what went on between America and the Houthis and the fact that Trump is in the Middle East right now, particularly in Saudi Arabia.
Barry, if I could just interrupt you for a second, I want to just comment about the arms sale, and then I'd love to talk about the Houthis. Let's keep in mind one thing about the Saudis, and that is that sometimes they buy this stuff just because it looks good on the runways.
Okay.
In other words, countries like Israel, the United States, have strategic projections, and they buy, or supposedly, we weren't so good at it in Israel for the past decade plus, but never mind. In theory, build our forces based on some sort of perceived threat. Countries like Saudi Arabia, I remember back in the days of the F-15 sales, Israel was very, very upset about it, 1980-ish. It turned out, really, they just wanted them to be sitting out there and they could take pictures of them. So I'm not saying that's the case, but we need to keep that in mind as well. Some of it is just prestige of saying this is what we've got. Sorry, Barry, the Houthis, absolutely important subject. Back to you.
Well, what I want to raise about this is the importance of this ragtag army and the way that it's looked at both in the Middle East, but apparently not in America. Because if we look back, what went on, we're led to believe that the Houthis said, okay, we're surrendering, we're not going to hit American ships anymore. Trump immediately said, okay, that we're not going to attack anymore. The truth is far different from that. Why did the Americans stop fighting the Houthis? Pentagon planners were concerned that the number of precision munitions that they had were depleting rapidly, because the American forces, as Elliot would confirm, had been bombarding the Yemen for about a month or so. I want to know some of the damage that they heard during that time. Americans will tell you, but they lost two fighter jets and one of the aircraft carrier was damaged. This is coming from the Houthis. They launched some very sophisticated, very expensive missiles that were either intercepted or didn't reach their target. There was a lot of bluster, a lot of arms, a lot of explosions, and nothing effective. So the truth that it was, others in the military also, and Elliot might confirm this, that to say that the Houthis said, okay, we're not going to hit US ships anymore, and then Biden says, that's it, we're not going to continue attacking Yemen. He said, they're not going to attack Yemen, but he didn't say, on the condition that you do not launch your missiles and ballistic missiles into Israel, then right. Will that reply? So we had this situation. Did Trump really, even in his final dealings with the Houthis, make an additional condition that would have protected Israel? No. And what happened since then?
Correct.
What happened was since then that even when Trump was in Saudi Arabia with the Crown Prince, the Houthis had the audacity to fire their ballistic missiles over the heads of the U.S. president and the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, over their heads, aiming towards Israel. And how did Israel respond to that? We didn't spend a month nightly bombing them. We targeted an airport and a seaport and said, your airport is destroyed and your seaport is destroyed. We didn't spend a month. We went out with specific targets, and now they've been denuded of a port and a seaport. And as we're talking today, Israel has sent out a timeless warning to people to get out, to leave the three major ports of Yemen. For your safety, remove yourself from these ports. We didn't say when we're going to attack. We did it for one reason. We were sending a warning to the foreign countries to get their ships out of this port because we do not want to destroy foreign ships.
Thank you for that.
But we're doing it because your viewers may hear in the coming days that attack have come suddenly from Israel and destroyed other Yemenite ports. This is part of our war against the Houthis. It's something that the Americans didn't do. They spent billions of dollars, denuded themselves of ammunition on a month's bluster with nothing effective achieved.
Good observation. I was thinking of this yesterday, Barry, when we, a little over 24 hours ago, had the latest of the Houthi missiles sent to Israel, sending us to the bomb shelters, and all worried in my family about my six-year-old grandson in first grade, who apparently was told by his bus driver that all the kids should take cover under the seats of their bus, which, right, okay, well, and I wrote about that. The it's about as effective of in the 1950s and 60s as American kids climbing
under school desks
for the potential nuclear attack from the Soviets. And I was thinking how lovely that we're giving the Houthis warning, but thank you. And they certainly not only don't, but they are deliberately trying to attack the weakest, the youngest and least defensible among us. But thank you for that extra dimension vis-a-vis the ships and the ports.
Let me end up with two factual information about the United States and the cost, right? The Houthis were managed to fend off seven US MQ-9 Reaper drones. This is with a total value of $200 million. And how did they manage to fend it off? With a Chinese satellite company.
Oy.
That's been aiding the Houthis attack. So here we have China in cahoots with the Houthis in foiling U.S. military attacks on the Houthis in Yemen.
It almost sounds like a country song with the characters. Elliot, did you want to? Yeah, I want to move on to Syria, did you want to add?
Okay, anything? Yes, I want to add actually three things from three different perspectives on this. Let me start with the American one.
Sure.
From the outset, and we learned this in part from the inadvertently leaked messaging that Jeffrey Goldberg was partner to, the American administration was ambivalent in the first place about taking on the Houthis. And we should know this is true about the administration's view on Israel as well. Within the administration, there are two camps, one of which is extremely isolationist, America first in the old-fashioned sense of the 1930s. And the other is much more sort of power-oriented in the use of power. And right now, the isolationists are gaining some greater influence. And it's, you know, it's a balance kind of thing. It's not all one way or the other, but it's enough to have that balance. In that conversation that was leaked, there was an entire section in which they were talking about the fact that, listen, this is a European problem, not an American problem, which is nonsense, by the way. Why are we doing this? Because, you know, one of the most important maritime arteries in the world is being cut by these guys. That's a good enough reason. The average American doesn't understand how much it's costing them for Maersk not to be using the Suez Canal. But that's part of what's going on in the background, as well as the fact that whoever planned this thing planned it for an 8 to 9 month operation that was measured after a month based on, and yes, the losses in terms of money are very high. Two F-18s falling off the deck of an aircraft carrier is $120 million, you know, just like that. They didn't fall off. I mean, the carrier was maneuvering to avoid a Houthi missile attack. But leaving that for a moment, if you're going to launch an operation and measure its success after a month, that's kind of like measuring the success of the European ground campaign in World War II based on D-Day.
Wow.
And, you know, D-Day, if you just measure that 24-hour period, look, so the Americans and Brits and Canadians took a strip of sand on the beach and lost, you know, 10,000 men in the process. And how much, if you stop at that point and say, what, this was a disaster. Okay. But if you look at it strategically, this is the first step toward victory.
Correct. It depends what your goal is.
Well, but if your original plan is an 8 or 9 month campaign,
yes,
you don't stop at the end of a month and say, you know, all right, it's not linear. Victory is not linear. It's an ascending curve. Your first steps, it's investment, strategic investment. When you put money into something, you're not expecting to gain in the first week or two. So it was an error in overall in perspective. That's from the American side. From the Israeli side, and here I absolutely agree with Barry, when we go after them, we have to go after them massively because let's face it, we can't do what the Americans were doing with two aircraft carriers sitting offshore. The Americans could launch multiple strikes. The distances are shorter. It's a whole different story. An Israeli strike against Yemen, against the Houthis in Yemen, is a major, major, major operation. And I give the Air Force extremely high grades on it, not only in terms of the effectiveness of the strikes, but the fact that no planes were lost. And here, not just to enemy activity, but, you know, a flight that long there and back and to have no mechanical failures is a tremendous credit to the ground crews and the maintenance people and that sort of thing, who are very often, you know, it's the pilots who get all the credit, and the people who are keeping the planes running are those men and women on the ground tightening the bolts. But tremendous credit on all of that.
On October 7th, 2023, Israel and the Jewish people suffered a massacre and calamity of unprecedented proportion, the largest number of Jews killed in one day since the Holocaust. That this is even something that we even measure is harrowing. Since then, the Jewish people have never felt more alone, in Israel and around the world. It brings us back to when 6 million of us were murdered in the Holocaust.
and few rose to protect us. However, those who did, the righteous among the nations, can never be forgotten. They serve as a beacon of light for us today and for future generations. Footsteps was born in the wake of this most recent calamity to give you the opportunity to walk in the footsteps of the righteous among the nations, the righteous Gentiles. Footsteps is a boutique travel experience with a personal touch. You will experience stories of the righteous among the nations, their descendants, of the Jews they saved, and the generations that came from them. Through this, you'll be inspired to follow in their footsteps to inspire new generations of righteous among the nations, especially today when so much of the world is embracing overt anti-Semitism. In a generation where standing up for Israel and the Jewish people is no longer something to be taken for granted, stories of the righteous among the nations call out to us, inspire us, and are models for today and for our next generations. Please join us and get more information at genesis123.co.
Having said all of what I've said, let's keep in mind the Houthis, like Hamas, like Hezbollah, are not taken out by a couple of strikes, or even and effective as they may be. And let's also keep in mind that as highly ideological operations, in this case religious ideology, jihadist ideology, very similar to the Nazis, and I use the analogy advisedly, they don't quit. In other words, the concept of convincing them to surrender by overwhelming damage is simply not going to work. And here Israel's caught in the horns of a dilemma. We must strike back against them, even though it is not going to have the effect that we would like it to have ultimately. And the reason we have to strike back against them is not only because of them, but because everybody else is watching as well. In other words, the Iranians have to know, and the Syrians and the Iraqis and everybody else have to know, if you fire at us, this is what we're going to do to you. And I'll finish with this point, and it's something that I've said for many, many years, and Israel has been not very good at this. We should be responding to every attack on Israel as if it succeeds, whether it succeeds or not.
Yes.
In other words, the response should be on the attempt, not on ultimate success. And it was a mistake that we made all through the years on rocket fire out of Gaza, rocket fire out of Lebanon, all sorts of attempts against us. If it didn't do damage, so to speak, you know, it fell in an open field, no injuries and no damage, we said, no blood, no foul. And that was a huge strategic mistake that we're still making, but less so as time goes on.
Thank you for that. I'm the person who's also in charge of keeping track of time. I think it's a great conversation and it could go on all day, but we have things to do. I do want to begin to close with two broader points. The first being about Syria. To me, it's very ironic and distasteful that the new leader of Syria, who was not leader of Syria 6 months ago, and through a coup, and none of us cried about Bashar Assad being thrown out and taking refuge in Russia. We'll be interested to see what his fate will be. But this new leader of Syria, who, Elliot, you went by his nom de guerre, Jolani, right?
Really?
Representing that he's got his roots in the Golan Heights, even though he's...
As if
Yasser Arafat were an actual Palestinian Arab, a useful reminder on what they call Nakba Day, and 4 months ago, this Jolani guy was on the U.S. most wanted list, having spent a huge amount of time in American custody because of his terrorist
activities. With a $10 million bounty on his head.
$10 million bounty. Now he shows up in a suit and tie, and Trump can't stop saying enough things about how handsome he is and how strong he is. And we're going to trust him and make a deal in Syria. All of that, and bringing in virtually Turkish President Erdogan, who's the puppeteer in Syria right now. I'm kind of curious what your thoughts are on all of that as it relates to Trump even having this meeting, ostensibly unfreezing sanctions and saying that we want to give Syria a chance. I don't think Trump said it in these exact words, but to make Syria great again. Barry Elliott.
Yeah. All right, you go.
All right. To say the jury is out on I don't call him Al-Julani. I call him for my name. He once called himself Al-Golani, because I think that gives away the secret of what drives the guy. And it's not the Golan Heights I'm talking about. It's the meaning of Golani as they're opening the door against Israel. Is this guy reformed because he's wearing a suit and tie? Don't believe it. He has to take more active steps. Obviously, Trump can speak to him, shake his hand, say he's a good-looking guy, and hopes that he will take a more positive approach to Israel. But until I hear it out of Al-Golani's mouth and not out of President Trump's, I'm not going to believe anything.
Good.
Okay. I wouldn't believe it even after I hear it from his mouth.
Excellent. So what do we, and there was no quid pro quo. There was nothing that it seems that the U.S. got from having had, it's one thing for the Saudis to invite him to be in the room. It's another thing entirely to have had this photo op and then brought in Erdogan. Now, if I go back to the first question that I asked in terms of what good came out of it, some analysts are saying, well, it's good because we're preventing worse actors from entrenching themselves in Syria. But the worst actor currently entrenched is Turkey. So what did this build up the Saudis' hand in Syria potentially against Turkey with which they have no love? What's your thoughts?
I think we have to be a little careful here in operating in what I call CNN time. Okay, we've learned to telescope everything down to days and weeks. There's a famous story, some say apocryphal, about Kissinger sitting with Chou En-lai sometime in the 70s, and over coffee turning to him and saying, what do you think of the outcome of the French Revolution? And Chou En-lai says, I don't know, too soon to tell. Which I think gives a very good idea of how a good part of the world, Middle East and Far East in particular, view the concept of time. We view the concept of time in terms of the next news cycle. So I would say here, legitimately, without tongue in cheek, too soon to tell about Syria. I'm willing to accept, not give, but accept the benefit of the doubt. But I'm also a firm believer in the saying that optimists are never pleasantly surprised. I would rather look at him with a bit of a jaundiced eye from where we're sitting. In other words, I have my issues with some of the tactical methods that we're using in Syria. I'm talking about Israel, but not with the overall idea of take out all of their heavy weapon capability against us, hold a belt buffer zone east of the Golan. We have to back the Druze, if for no other reason, if not humanitarian, certainly for internal Israeli purposes, social political purposes. These are all things that, in general, I think we're doing correctly. Like I said, I have criticism about certain elements of it, but that's not for this conversation. But it's all based on the idea of, you know what? Let's watch. Let's see. There's a Hebrew term for this, kabdeu v'chashdeu. Let's respect him, but suspect him. I'm talking about, as you call him, Al-Golani. Maybe the guy really does want to put Syria together. Maybe he really has changed. But show me. Prove it. It's not just rhetoric. And you know what? 6 months from now or a year from now, there's plenty of time for us to approach and make all sorts of tentative checks and deals along with that. Now, certainly premature, and what Trump did doesn't hurt us necessarily. I'd like to really know what's going on in Trump's mind. Does he believe what's going on there, or is he just throwing it out as okay, let's give it a chance. It doesn't cost America anything to do it.
So the operative word, cost America anything, because the implications, it does. You know, some years ago in his first term, Trump referred to Syria, I think, as a bunch of sand as he was going to withdraw final troops. And
that's right.
By simply withdrawing, creating the vacuum, we know Turkey's the one who calling the shots there, but then it was Iran and
correct.
Hezbollah. And so it does. There's certainly an indirect consequence.
Always.
Right. Barry, what do you want to add to that about Syria?
I want, Jonathan, through you to ask Elliot something. And because you just touched on it, Turkey. Erdogan sees the resurrection of al-Gulani being in charge of Syria as a resurrection of the Ottoman Empire, or the start of the Ottoman Empire.
Yes.
And I think that if truth be told, Erdogan sees Gulani sitting in Damascus as the Jamal Pasha of this century.
Ooh, good.
Jamal Pasha was one of the overlords of the Ottoman Empire, ruling from Damascus, and he ruled over not only what was called then Palestine, which we call Israel, but also Jordan, Lebanon, Syria. And I think an ambitious Erdogan is looking at al-Gulani as the guy that he can operate. I'm asking, phrasing it this way, to ask Elliot this question. What would be the situation of, let's say, the United States, let alone Israel, if Turkey, if Erdogan offers, volunteers al-Gulani some of the Turkish fighter planes as a defensive tool in order to protect Gulani's Syria?
Certainly, we're the whole Turkish question, and I'm glad you raised it, because that's obviously the question behind the question. Let me start with one point and then get to yours. What Erdogan believes about Gulani and what Trump believes about Gulani are two different things. The question is, what does Gulani think about Gulani? And that we don't know yet. Okay. In other words, he could be playing everybody and saying, wait until I get rid of all of you. I'm going to take charge. Remember, his position at the moment is still a bit precarious. He hasn't solidified control over the entire country. So he's playing. And once again, I'm not predicting. He could go this way, could go that way, could go a third way. But let's keep in mind that we don't know what's going on in his mind. And that's where I say that the jury is out. As far as Erdogan is concerned, Erdogan is an enemy of Israel, period. And he's not a friend of the United States either. You mentioned the American base, Incirlik, in Turkey. Incirlik is surrounded by Turkish troops. In other words, the Americans in Turkey are under siege, and they have been for a number of years. This is the great NATO ally of the United States. If he decides to move, and he's suddenly now been given a certain amount of freedom that he didn't have before, as the Kurds have basically called off their war against him.
Yeah.
In other words, he has now surplus military force that he didn't have a month ago. We could very well be fighting a proxy war with Turkey on the edges of one, a low-intensity one, in the not-too-distant future. And yes, Barry, I think that's a very, very serious concern, keeping in mind that Erdogan is two things. You mentioned one, the Ottoman Empire, and he sees himself as the next sultan of the Ottoman Empire. He's also a hardcore Muslim Brotherhood jihadist. So the two kind of, you know, merge. One is geopolitical power, and the other is radical Islamic power. By the way, we see that with Iran as well, in its own imperial as well as religious perspective. So it's something I think that's lost on the West, and that is the the amalgam, the hybrid of good old-fashioned imperialism mixed with modern jihadi, I call it Nazism, because that's really what, you know, where it came out of, that has its own religious element to it beyond the simple strategic geopolitical.
This year, you can join Christian leaders from around the world who are lining up to participate in Root and Branch, the newest hands-on, meaningful, and incredibly tangible way for Christians to make a personal connection to Israel, the Israeli people, and to be a blessing to the people and nation which is still suffering from the trauma of a horrific terrorist attack and war. Root and Branch offers unique comfort and a vision of peace, with tangible material benefits to Israelis who have suffered the trauma of war, specifically in and around the Gaza border area. Root and Branch is a unique agricultural pilgrimage. You will harvest wild olive trees in communities along the Gaza border that were devastated by the October 7, 2023 terrorist attack and massacre. In these communities and elsewhere, we will plant deep and lasting roots among Israelis of all backgrounds, making Root and Branch all the more innovative. Since the war began, more than $50 million in crops have been saved by volunteers. Root and Branch is the first such initiative to harvest olives. Proceeds from the olive oil that's being made will directly benefit these devastated communities, making Root and Branch a critical and significant project to bless Israel economically and spiritually in multiple ways. Root and Branch is a partnership between the Genesis 123 Foundation and NewPersia.org. For information, videos, and media about the experience, dates, pricing, and how you can register, please visit rootandbranchisrael.com.
Well, it's also interesting, Elliot, that Erdogan was brought into this conversation with the Syrian leader in Saudi Arabia, where we know that the Saudis and the Turks are not in love with each other, right. Have tremendous right. conflict, and almost, it's hard to say where that came from. Maybe Trump does truly feel like he has a great relationship, but Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince, must not have felt really great about
Juan
being in the room, even virtually.
Let's also keep in mind that in the Middle East, everywhere in the world, talk is cheap. It's even cheaper in the Middle East.
There you go. Okay. Let's thank you. There's so many more directions we can go on this, but I like to really truly begin to conclude where we are. How does all of this impact Israel? What should we be looking at? Barry, you reiterated a point that I mentioned in my opening remarks in terms of the deal that was cut with the Houthis, and you emphasized some of the things and the negotiations with Iran, and we haven't heard Iran being spoken about tremendously in public, if at all, this week. Witkoff is busy, so he's not flying off to meet with the other operatives, other than Idan Alexander and Israeli negotiators also flying off to Qatar, ostensibly to have more negotiations on a deal to release the remaining 58 hostages. There's a lot in play. There was a major Israeli attack in Gaza the other night, the target being Mohammed
Sinwar.
And hopefully he's had his reunion with his brother, but we don't know that. That's not been determined. But there's a lot in play, and Trump is, whether he's physically left Qatar and flown to UAE by now, or he will be doing so and spend a day in the UAE and then flying back to America. He may overfly Israel, but he's not stopping here. Where from any of these perspectives, where does that leave us? Where does that leave Israel in this equation? In the back of the bus, off the bus, on the bus, waving at the bus.
In my opinion, we're in the back of the bus, and some stage in the near future, probably starting at the end of this month, we're going to come off the bus vis-a-vis Gaza. I'm also going to come off the bus, maybe giving it another month. Elliot might agree with me or not, to see how Steve Witkoff manages to outwit and outsmart and outnegotiate the Iranians, which is an impossible task because they are the world leaders, even better than Qatar and Saudi Arabia, in fooling and deceiving the West as they've done in the past. Whether at that stage Trump is going to say, okay, there's no deal with these people, go ahead and do what you have to do with vis-a-vis to Iran, or whether Israel will do it itself if we find out that a month or so goes by and the Trump administration is being deceived into another false deal. I don't know whether Elliot agrees with that or whether he has observations.
Totally, yes.
I don't know what time frame you would put on it, Elliot.
First of all, I agree with you 100% on both. I would add just one more thing to that, and that is that the perception that America is either abandoning or back-of-the-busing Israel is dangerous in its own right. It was dangerous during the Biden administration, certainly after October 7th. We know for a fact what was speculated, more than educated guessing, but that Hamas was toughening up their demands every time America did something like that has been confirmed. The Iranian strikes against Israel were both in the immediate aftermath of America saying, we weren't part of whatever it was, whether it was taking out Haniya in Tehran. And even though, and I think this is very important, even though America did take part in the defense of Israel, the perception that it wouldn't was very dangerous and led to negative results by our not so friendly neighbors, whether it's Hamas or Iran or Hezbollah or anybody else. Keeping in mind that they are all sitting and waiting for that moment. I mean, this is not just our enemies. I can give you other examples. April Gillespie with Saddam Hussein prior to the Gulf War, giving the implication that America didn't care about Kuwait, going back to statements made in 1950, leaving South Korea out of the list and prompting the North Korean attack in June 1950. In other words, these people are sitting and waiting for the message that little hint that America isn't interested or isn't involved. And that hint is out there now very heavily, and it doesn't matter whether it's correct or not.
Correct. Excellent point.
There's one other point, Jonathan, we need to raise before I guess we wrap up. And that is the big elephant in the room when Trump was there with Mohammed bin Salman. And I asked him, or requested him, to join the Abraham Accords. And Mohammed bin Sultan said, no. I'm sure Elliot has some views on this. I have mine. And my part was really, he said, no, because he has a different vision for the future of Gaza. And that vision is not acceptable to Israel. And that is, it should be ruled by Mahmoud Abbas and the Palestinian Authority. And he's still putting his money on that horse. And therefore, if Trump went all the way to the Middle East, and one of the prizes he wanted to take back, apart from enriching both America and himself, was to bring Saudi Arabia aboard the Abraham Accord partnership, he failed on that.
Elliot, last words on that?
I agree. But here again, no doesn't mean no. No means make me a better offer. And the Saudis are playing it. I don't think they want Israel. They don't want to be part of the Abraham Accords. They want the benefits of being part of the Abraham Accords. And they're going to ratchet them up as high as they possibly can. And if they don't get what they want, it doesn't cost them anything to say no.
And Trump
has
as a result of this trip, Trump hasn't made it a negative thing, not being part of the Abraham Accords.
Correct. Correct. There are no sanction consequences of saying no.
Right. Okay.
But he got out of Trump everything he wanted, and
that's my point.
So he has no reason to get in right now.
That was my point.
On Hamas and not on Israel. And that's the troubling situation that I see for Gaza after the war. And I want to tell you, there's a lot of delusion going on in some of the parameters that are being organized here. Because I don't know if you've read some of the small print about what's being cooked up for Gaza, that it's going to be led by the Palestinian Authority. Wait for it, in the small print at the end, with the Hamas acting as a police force in protection of the Gaza. Did you hear
that?
Read the small print.
That's going to be another conversation, Barry. But if I may borrow your earlier comments as my concluding comments, the deal of the century that Trump spoke about at the beginning of his first term, and did by delivering the Abraham Accords, is now potentially, as a result of this week, going back to what you observed when I asked what were the positives, the deals of the century, meaning the economic deals. And Saudi Arabia was not required to be part of Abraham Accords or pushed into it. And that wasn't all of the other deals were ready to sign. They weren't negotiated while Trump was president. They were ready to sign, both in Saudi Arabia and in Qatar. And I don't think he mentioned anything about the Qataris joining the Abraham Accords. He did mention it about Syria, but that hasn't got any legs at the moment. Gentlemen, I know that this has been a great conversation. We truly could go on. We're having some reception issues with my friend Chisholm Martins, who's joining, and I hope he can unmute now because I've asked him to join us from Nigeria for 2 minutes just to close out in prayer.
Wow. Shalom, everyone.
Shalom.
Shalom.
Thank you. It's been a very great conversation. I've actually learned a lot too. And most importantly, the concern that there are people out there who are also participating and actively concerned on how to advance the general well-being of Israel. This has always been my thought. Because by one person, we can go so far, but two of us can go much further. So thank you so much for all you do. And Mr. Jonathan, I thank you for the opportunity to add the prayer. Because Psalm 127, we say, if the Lord does not watch over the city, in vain does the watchman watch. And there is no best way to pray than to recite the Psalm of David, who actually is a very great leader in Israel, a king, and one of the main founding fathers of Israel. So I'll take a prayer from Psalm 79. And I just want to start from verse 8. And I pray, "Oh, do not remember for my iniquities against us. Let your tender mercies come speedily to us, for we have been brought very low." So this is the low time in Israel. "Help us, O God, for our salvation, for the glory of your name, and deliver us and provide atonement for our sins, for your name's sake. Why should the nations say, 'Where is their God?' Let there be known among the nations in our sight the avenging of the blood of your servants, which has been shed. Let the groaning of the captives be before you, and let the prisoners come before you. According to the greatness of your power, preserve those who are appointed unto death, and return to our neighbors sevenfold unto their bosom their reproach with which they have reproached you, O Lord. So we, your people, and sheep of your pasture, we give you thanks forever. And we will show forth the praise to all Jena rations. So we're praying the Psalm of David before the Lord this morning, asking that even as the captives are in Gaza, that the strong hand of the Lord, who has delivered continuously without fail over the generations, will also do so this time around, as he has done and as it is recorded from one generation to another, that we will see miraculous intervention in the release of the hostages that has been held in Gaza, and also that there will be good news continuously concerning Israel, and that those who have come up together to take counsels, every of those counsels that is contrary to what the Lord has spoken concerning Israel, even as it were, that when Balaam set out to take counsel with the king of the Moab and the Hittite and all the rest against Israel, the scripture made it very clear, said, and it pleases the Lord to bless Israel. So whatever counsel that has been taken, is it in Riyadh? Is it in Doha? Is it in Washington? It doesn't matter where that counsel has been taken together. Let only the counsel of the Lord prevail. And that counsel of the Lord is what? It pleases the Lord to bless Israel, as it has been from the time of Abraham. Let it continue to be that the Lord will bless his people, that the Lord will cause Israel to grow from strength to strength. In Yeshua's name we pray. Amen.
Thank you so much. A great comfort and a great way to wrap up when we're talking about so many contentious issues. And I thank you for that, and rooting your prayer in one of the critical books that we as Jews and Christians both share in Psalms. Eliot Chodov, Barry Shaw, thank you. A delightful conversation. Not our last, and there'll be a lot to observe in the coming days and weeks ahead. Thank you for joining again. As we have done now for years, almost since the inception of Inspiration from Zion, the Genesis 1-1-2-3 Foundation wants to thank you for following our programs and wants to offer you a special gift. Each month, we have a special opportunity. We call it From Jonathan's Bookshelf. And every month, we give away a special volume just for following and liking and commenting and sharing the link to this program. This month, as we've done since just before the beginning of the war, the book that we're offering is our book that we published in September of 23, just before the war began, Israel the Miracle. It's a stunning a compilation of 75 essays by Christian leaders from all over the world writing about why Israel is so significant. And all we ask that you do is comment, like, or share the link to this program. And every month we pick one person at random to receive a free copy worth $75. We're grateful that this podcast is sponsored by our friends at the Willow Run Greenhouse in Culpeper, Virginia. And if you're ever in the area, I always say pop in and thank them for helping make conversations like this possible. And special thanks to the Coyne family as well for their meaningful sponsorship. Inspiration from Zion and all the Genesis 1-2-3 Foundation programs are made possible by donations. So please consider joining us to help continue the dialogue and build bridges. And I, as the host, I have the special prerogative of congratulating myself and my wife, who's listening live in the other room, on the impending marriage of our daughter this coming Monday. You can follow that live on the Genesis 1-2-3 Foundation YouTube channel, which will be broadcast here as well, and as a way to build bridges with our Christian friends all over the world. And if you'd like to sponsor a future episode in honor or memory of a loved one or special occasion, please be in touch with us at inspirationfromzion@gmail.com. We'd love to hear your comments as well, and always as part of a dialogue, and invite you to share any questions specifically about traditional Judaism for our Ask the Rabbi programs. Please share this with others who will also find it of interest, and continue to join us right here, where we bring you more meaningful conversations about unique topics relating to Israel that you won't hear anywhere else. Wherever you are in the world, I send my blessings and prayers that you and your loved ones are all safe and healthy from right here in the Judean Mountains. Thank you for the panelists for joining us today, and God bless you. Hallelujah.